Why should we care about Alan Turing? Why is his centennial such a big deal?
Well, certainly a lot's being made of Alan Turing's centennial. And that's really, I suppose, because he was the founder of computer science. And everyone's now involved with computers in a very personal way, in a way that really wouldn't have been possible until quite recently. And somehow he just, well, he was at the beginning of it. He had the first ideas about modern computing. And he had a very personal relationship with computing. He was interested in minds and in people and how he relates to what computers do. So that puts him right in the centre of things.
I'm curious about Turing the man, or Turing the child even. When did his gift for math and science first appear?
He was quite distinctive for doing something very important when he was pretty young. He was only 23, 24 when he made his first big breakthrough in the theory of computing. And indeed, he did show this interest in fundamental science and logical thought when he was pretty young. So when he was at school, which is a very old-fashioned sort of English school, he somehow managed to get in touch with what was going on in science in the 1920s. He learnt about relativity and quantum mechanics, and you can see him from his notes, reading Einstein's semi-popular book about relativity and studying it hard and actually noticing where Einstein had left something out that he thought he ought to have put in and correcting him. That was pretty good, actually. So that we see in a very young age in his intellectual quest for foundations.
And he went on to some of the best schools in England, somewhat surprisingly, I guess, although not a surprise because of his ability, more because no one had any reason to expect it of him.
There was no real family background, generational push towards intellectual distinction in his life. His father was a civil servant in the British Empire in India, and his mother's family were engineers in India, actually. It's essentially the connection. So a little bit of scientific engineering input, but not really substantial. Far the most important thing in his background was this British sort of class status thing, which propelled him through what you had to do as a young person then. He had to follow the laid down route, really. He went through this school system and won a scholarship to Cambridge University, which is one of the two elite universities in England of that time, 1931.
But there was more than that there, wasn't there? He had a relationship with another young man, Christopher Morcom, and that was in some ways a turning point.
Well, there's a very interesting story there about the whole nature of where originality and real scientific impetus comes from. The person who really brought him out of isolation and made him someone who was actually communicating and thinking of collaborative life in science was this other boy called Christopher Morcom at this Sherborne School. There are several things mixed together here. I mean, he was obviously also a very bright boy, full of interest in science and fundamentals in the same way. But also, it was at this time that Alan Turing must have been becoming aware of his identity as a gay man, because his feelings for this other boy were obviously something quite out of the ordinary, and I think he was becoming strongly aware of that at that time. It was not a romantic relationship. I think the feelings were entirely on Alan Turing's side, and they wouldn't have been shared. But it's obviously something extremely special. And what made the story very dramatic is that Christopher Morcom suddenly died in 1930, just after he'd got the scholarship to Cambridge and all set for a scientific career. And the combination of intellectual loss but great emotional and romantic loss must have been absolutely very, very traumatic for Alan Turing at that time, and he was only 18.
But I did have the feeling from the way you wrote about it that in some ways Turing's pursuit of intellectual accomplishment was to some degree a desire to do what he thought Morcom would have been able to do had he lived.
Well, he did actually say something like that. Of course, you can say something like that when you're 19 and really not mean very much a little bit later. In 1932, he wrote a little essay for Christopher Morcom's mother. And it's an essay about the problem of scientific determinism. It's the classical problem of how you can have free will and minds and consciousness in a world which seems to be just governed by physical law. He put himself into that intellectual framework in a way that's absolutely clear from what he's saying, that he's thinking about the departure of Christopher's mind, how it is that a mind could exist in this physical sense and then disappear and then be at an end. What on earth happens And he's trying to reconcile that with a scientific picture, and he finds some reconciliation in the quantum mechanical picture. Of course, that's an extraordinary thing to do. Not many people try and reconcile their deep emotional feelings by thinking about modern theories in science. But it shows the whole grounding of his thought, his caring so deeply about the puzzle of what the mind is, how it's related to the physical world, how we can describe it in a scientific way. Those are the things which he pushed forward in the rest of his scientific career.
Well, and you can see in this the beginnings of a personality that is highly unusual. Now, you've talked with hundreds of people, family members and friends. You've read everything you could find. What sense did you get of what kind of person Alan Turing was? I mean, if you were going to go have a beer with a man, how would you read him? What kind of man would you say he is?
Well, he had many complex characteristic, odd features. I mean, he had funny ways. You had to be on his wavelength, really, to get on. But there were several different wavelengths, so there were various different possible ways in which he was approachable. But if you're very serious and really cared about scientific mathematical ideas, he would be right on to whoever you were. I mean, he wouldn't care about your rank or position. And he certainly very much liked encouraging young people and so on who were just starting in it. On the other hand, he wasn't at all snobbish, so he really, in a way, liked to be quite ordinary and not like a Cambridge don or anything like that at all. So, for instance, later on, he went in a lot for long-distance running and certainly would have got out a lot of just joshing along with an amateur running group. He liked that kind of thing as well. And when he moved around, he stayed in ordinary places and liked mixing in a very unposh sort of way. He was also very direct. If you were getting on with him, it would be no good to do anything slightest bit pretentious, or he really just see through that right away. I mean, one of his favourite words would be pseudo for describing things he didn't like.
You can imagine a man like that being sometimes a little difficult to work with.
Oh, that's absolutely true. So, of course, a lot of administration and hierarchies, people like that don't fit in very well. No, he didn't fit in very well like that. What he fitted in very well was when it needed something quite original, something quite special, something that no one else would touch with a barge pole, really, but he would come along and have a go at. And then he could do something very special, as indeed he did on more than one occasion.
He lived in an extraordinary time, I guess you'd have to say. He lived in the 1930s, just as the world was breaking into war. And one of the things that he is best remembered for is the work that he did for the British Secret Service for code breaking, figuring out the way to solve the Enigma coding that the Germans were using.
One of the most striking things about his timeline is something that was generally true of the world in 1939. It was a period at which the most advanced and abstruse kinds of science suddenly turned out to have highly practical application. I mean, the most obvious one is the atomic bomb development, but the code breaking was another example of that. And it's where he was exactly of the right age and just the right place in the whole scheme of things that he realized he could turn these really quite advanced ideas on logic, the ideas which actually led to the idea of the computer, and turn that whole frame of mind into a serious, modern 20th century look at the whole problem of codes and ciphers.
It's important to remember, too, isn't it, how much was at stake at this time. The U-boats were sinking everything in sight that was trying to get from America to England. England was very much under threat, and so breaking the German codes was extremely important.
Well, specifically, it was the Atlantic naval Enigma traffic that was very important. And clearly, the sea war is more information-dependent than almost any other aspect of warfare. The routing and the sighting of convoys and the engagements and so forth were all highly dependent on radio messages. And for that reason, the naval messages were better protected, and they were more secure, they had extra levels of complexity, which made their Enigma methods much more hard to solve than the other ones. And it was that business, it was the naval signals that Alan Turing took on in 1940 as his own patch, a thing that seemed really quite impossible at first.
So what did he do? What did he build in order to break the German code?
Well, there's more than one thing here. There was his idea for what's called the bomb, which enormously enhanced an idea for mechanizing search procedures, which the Polish mathematicians had invented, but took that to a completely new pitch by having a machine which could search for certain logical consistency conditions, which Turing located as the crucial things about how the Enigma worked. That applied to all Enigma messages, essentially. And that could be used as long as you had enough information about the nature of the communications to guess with fair certainty a fairly long patch of what the plain text was behind some piece of ciphertext. That's a very non-trivial demand, but it could be met.
In other words, if you could translate one short portion, enough of it to feed it into the machine could begin to look for that kind of logic through the rest.
It did. It was able to do that. And the miracle was that it could do that in a matter of hours rather than weeks. I mean, the numbers and the technology just made that possible. If the system had been just a little bit more complicated, that wouldn't have been possible. It was a very, very critical thing. So that applied to Enigma messages in general, but the naval messages were more complicated. They used more rotors. They had this extra enciphering system on the front and various other things that came in, made it more difficult. And that needed, what Turing did was to devise a whole, what we'd now call information theory. It's a way of measuring information, and it really just brought the whole business of guessing, estimating, measuring, detecting, put it all on a scientific basis, and nothing to do with sort of guessing and having a go. It became an algorithmic business, actually, looking forward to what computers do. That was really what Turing did. He put it onto a completely new scientific footing in a way that it could be industrialized and turned into regular output day after day.
So is this essentially the beginning of the modern computer?
Well, it's the beginning of really serious algorithms, I'd say. That is to say, things you would now do on a computer program. But they didn't have computers then. Computers didn't exist until they got started in the later 1940s. But Turing's an important bridge there. His idea in 1936 had been for what he called the universal machine. It was a completely new concept. The funny thing about what Turing did was that he had the idea of computer programs before there were any computers. And then he invented the computer as a way to make sense of the computer programs. I know that sounds a bit crazy, but that's essentially what he did. And it sort of shows the peculiarity of the way he approached things.
He saw how all of this fit together. And yet he maintained in his mind the relationship between mind and machine. He was able to see that it wasn't just computing.
That's very, very true. You see, his original thoughts are about the mind. And in fact, his model of computation that he did in 1936 and gave rise to everything was based on analyzing what the mind does. And when computers got going, I mean, he had to sell the idea of the computer for practical purposes, but they weren't really what he was fundamentally interested in. I mean, he just knew they could be used for all sorts of things, everything that people do now. In fact, with computers, he essentially saw the scope of it. But he said right from the beginning in 1945 that he saw it as an effort to emulate the brain and see what the brain does, experiment with what is going on in brains. And so right from the start, he's thinking about chess playing programs, and not only programs to do chess playing, but programs which will pose the question, can you call this intelligence?
You have to wonder in all of this whether he wasn't as much trying to figure out why he was who he was, how his own mind worked, as he was trying to emulate it mechanically.
What's very striking is that if you read his paper published in 1950 about the artificial intelligence question, it leaps off the page in comparison with philosophical writing in the same journal of that period, which looks very, very dry and academic. It's full of jokes, it's full of wits, it's full of funny illustrations, all sorts of cultural references. And I think you could sum it up by saying there's a subtext there that although he's writing about what machines could do and arguing that probably there's no limit to what machines could do, at least we should find out anyway, that's his view. Certainly shouldn't assume before you start what the limits are. Nevertheless, he's actually putting forward in the subtext a rather strong message that he, though a mathematician, is human. And he's showing by his awareness of human life in a very marked way with lots of things that other people wouldn't put in, sort of risque elements, cultural elements, which make it fun and show that he's not thinking of computing as just something to do with getting the right answer, calculating, number crunching, those sort of things.
Well, and in his personal life, he was also bringing some of the bluntness or openness of computing into his humanity, wasn't he? I mean, the whole question of his homosexuality at a time when, in England, that was against the law, he was very open about it, though. Once he discovered who he was and how he felt, he didn't see any reason to hide it.
He came to that kind of view after the war, I think. I mean, before the war, he certainly was quite open within the confines of King's College, Cambridge, which was a very special environment. But notably, he wasn't content to just to sit within that protected environment. The war and then computers took him much further afield. And after the war, he certainly had much more confidence in his own identity and settled for it and tried to make best of it, I think that we'd say, and basically had a very modern point of view. Certainly also as a scientist, mathematician, dishonesty comes not a welcome thing, any kind of concealment. I mean, it's against the nature and the whole mentality of pure science.
This worked very much against him, though, in the real world.
Well, the other trouble was that in 1948, things changed in a quite different direction. It's essentially the beginning of the Cold War, and it's also the beginning of the concept of security and vetting and so forth, which put him outside the pale in a way that hadn't been true during the Second World War, where class background of being a good chap in the English sense is really all that mattered. So he was at a grave situation in the early 1950s, when there was a great rise in number of prosecutions of gay men under the law as it was then. I mean, the same law as that which Oscar Wilde was prosecuted.
Yeah, he was quite naive about this, though, wasn't he? He was arrested, in fact, because he turned himself in to the police. A guy he had picked up had burgled his home, and he made no bones about it. He said that this had happened because of that, and the police paid little attention to the crime, I guess, and more to his illegal act of being gay.
That's basically what happened. I mean, he didn't actually just rush to tell them what it was. I think he made up some sort of cover story, but it didn't last very long. They rapidly put two and two together. As far as the actual circumstances of the arrest and trial was concerned, it was an absolute classic. It came to light through an injudicious relationship with an outcome to do with petty crime, one where he didn't quite know how to handle it, and where, as you say, the police seized on it as something they could easily get credit for prosecuting.
Once he was found guilty of this crime against the British law, he was given a choice, I gather, between imprisonment or chemical castration?
Yes, it was. That's what it was. It was injections of estrogen. And the theory of it was, yes, that it would just remove sexual interest.
He chose that, and you can understand why he would do that instead of imprisonment. But how did they affect him?
Well, it had serious physical effects. It only went on for a year. And that was the period of his probation. And then he had the implant removed. I mean, obviously, it's an extremely humiliating and distressing thing to happen to anyone, let alone someone who had a really proud independence and a great dislike of being interfered with in any way. His whole attitude was one of bravado, and that he talked about it quite openly to other people, and also defiance, really, that his main obvious reaction was to insist on going abroad, that he went to Scandinavia, to Norway in 1952, and then to Greece in 1953, almost certainly to Norway because he sensed or knew something about the beginnings of the Scandinavian gay movement, which was a very early European gay rights organization of that period.
And then in 1954, he was found dead of cyanide poisoning. People generally assume that it was suicide, but do we know?
I'm sure it was suicide, and the way he did it was as a theatrical way, but it was designed to allow anyone who wished to believe it could have been an accident, that it was a play on his own penchant for chemical experiments and of being messy, of not being practical. And it also had a symbolism. He used this symbolism of the apple, but the apple has a symbolic meaning, I think.
It's the 100th anniversary of Turing's birth. There have been celebrations all over the world. Has anything changed? Have there been particularly significant or meaningful reassessments of Turing?
Some things are just the same as they were in 1936. The definition of computability that Turing found, nothing's changed that. It's still absolutely the definitive foundation of a whole branch of mathematics and the origin of computer science as a science. So in that way, it hasn't changed at all. I mean, what computers have done may be quite different from what people would have thought in the 1940s. They're far smaller, cheaper, far more of them, do far more. But the basic principles are just the same.